Hello and welcome to the Medical Women Podcast, the world's first podcast aimed at supporting and empowering medical women in their careers. I'm Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram, and it's my honour and joy to be your host as each week we speak to a fantastic guest who's here to help us in our careers. I'm Vice President of the Medical Women's Federation, the largest body of women doctors in the UK, and the voice of medical women on medical issues. Join us as each week we hear about a topic that's helpful for all of us in our careers. Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to this week's episode of the Medical Women Podcast. This is actually the second introduction that I'm recording to this episode because the initial introduction I recorded and was really quite cross at the announcement that on Friday, the 12th of April, an announcement was made on X, formerly known as Twitter, about the decommissioning of the NHS Practitioner Health Service for secondary care doctors. And spent quite a lot of time this weekend alongside other colleagues working out what can we do to make a difference. And it's been amazing to see collaboration with lots of colleagues and also so many people who have shared bravely their stories of their own journeys with mental health and how practitioner health not only saved their career but also saved a lot of people's lives. And I'm now re-recording the intro because I'm delighted that there's been a complete U-turn on the decision. And it's going to continue for the next year whilst NHS England reviews the service, which actually that would have been the sensible thing to do in the first place. Like, why would you axe a service before you conduct the review? So I'm glad that they have come to the sensible decision, but I think really it highlights a perfect example of what I talk about on this podcast a lot. So those who are regular listeners will be used to me saying this maybe every week. Those who are new, you will get used to me talking about this. But I say quite a lot on the podcast that issues that we're dealing with, racism, sexism, these are like entrenched issues that are systemic and within society and within the medical profession or healthcare in general. And they're not an individual's fault, but they are systemically an issue. But I don't ever want people to feel that, oh, well, it's a system problem and I'm just an individual, so I can't make a difference. As individuals, you absolutely can make a difference. And particularly when a group of individuals come together, this is a perfect example of that. So, you know, Dr. Rachel Clark, who wrote Breathtaking, which was recently made into a TV series. I haven't actually watched it myself yet because just thought it would be too triggering to watch something that's all about being in the pandemic. But I know it's an amazing book. And Dr. Rachel Clark wrote a letter that was shared widely as an open letter. And in the end, over 15,000 NHS staff signed the letter. So many amazing, brave doctors have been sharing their personal journeys on Twitter. And all of that has then made NHS England and the Department of Health and Social Care have to listen. So never, ever feel that you can't make a difference as an individual. We absolutely can. And it's by individuals making change and working together that we change systems. So this week's episode is all about the topic of doctors' mental health and well-being. And I appreciate that this is a really sensitive topic. And if there is anyone listening who is struggling right now, please know that you're not alone. And there'll be some links in the show notes for places that you can go to for help. But I did think it is really important to have this conversation. And again, I've said this several times on the podcast, that I want this to be a place where we have the conversations that aren't happening. There are still issues around talking about mental health. There's still quite a lot of stigma around mental health, but it's so important that we talk about it. And that's why I think it was amazing that over the weekend, so many people were bravely sharing their stories of their own journeys and how help from practitioner health has has really helped them in their careers and also in their lives. It's such an important topic, and yet we don't talk about it. And that then means that people feel isolated and that there's something wrong with them, or that, oh, everybody else can cope and it's just me that can't cope. Or there's a feeling of like no one else is struggling, but I am. And I think it's through having these conversations that we can normalize things and understand that actually nobody's going through this by themselves. There's nothing wrong with anyone, but it is so isolating and you feel so alone when you are going through either a difficult time or if you are in the midst of having mental health issues. So it is really, really important that we have these conversations, and I really hope that this conversation does inspire people to talk more about it. So my guest today is the amazing, wonderful human that goes by the Twitter handle of the Bipolar Doctor. And our guest is somebody who I came across on Twitter. And I was delighted when they said that that they love listening to the podcast and that they have found the podcast really helpful. I'm always really touched when people get in touch and say that, because it's one of those things where it just goes out into the ether. I have no idea who's listening, what they're doing while they're listening to it. Maybe I don't want to know what you're doing while you're listening to it. But yeah, I have no idea who's listening and what they thought of it and whether they actually found it helpful or not. I mean, given the fact that we've had over 12,300 listens now, and I do look at the stats, and there's between 100 to 200 of you listening every week. Clearly, people do find it helpful, or you wouldn't listen and you wouldn't come back. So thank you, and thank you for sharing it so widely with people. But it was so nice to receive a message from the bipolar doctor saying that they found the podcast really helpful, and I was really delighted that they agreed to come on the podcast, because it is very brave to be sharing publicly about your own journey. And for those who don't know, the bipolar doctor does share incredibly bravely and vulnerably on social media about her career and her journey. I'm not really going to mention it now because they will speak about that themselves on the podcast. But I'm so grateful to the bipolar doctor for sharing her story on social media, and also for being brave enough to come on the podcast and speak about it, because it's through conversations like this that we can make a difference and we can reduce the stigma around doctors having mental health issues, and normalize having conversations about looking after ourselves and our mental health. So I really hope that you find this episode insightful and inspiring. I am absolutely sure that you will. And just before we get into the episode, I just want to quickly mention that our upcoming spring conference is happening in Cambridge on Friday, the 10th of May, with a conference dinner on the 9th of May. It would be so wonderful to see you there. As I've just said about the podcast, it's very one way, and I can't actually interact with any of you. So it would be great to get to interact with you face to face. And yes, definitely let me know if you're going to be there. And if you are there on the day and you listen to the podcast, please come and tell me what your favorite episodes have been, what you think has been helpful, what you'd like to see more of. I would love to hear from you. So I'll pop a link in the show notes to register as well. I hope you enjoy this week's episode with our wonderful guest, the Bipolar Doctor. Welcome back to the Medical Women podcast, and it's lovely to have our guest with me. So, a little bit different this week. I am not going to be introducing our guest by their name. We're going to be using their Twitter name, and I'm going to ask you if you can introduce yourself to our listeners.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. Well, like you said, I'm not going to be using my real name today. Instead, I'll be going by my Twitter handle, which is the Bipolar Doc. And I suppose that is because my story is one of vulnerability, and one that I think is still for me associated with quite a lot of perceived stigma and self-stigma, actually. And it makes me uncomfortable to share that on such a sort of wide platform. So for now, I'll just be the Pibola doc.
Well, a very warm welcome to the Medical Women podcast. And thank you for coming on here to share your story. And thank you for all of the posts that you do put out on Twitter. I've followed you for a while, and it's, you know, I'm not surprised that there's lots of engagement and things with what you post, because you talk about things that we don't really talk about in medicine. So it'd be great if you could share whatever you're comfortable with from your story with us.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the whole Twitter thing baffles me a little bit, because when I set out to create the account, it was whilst I was off sick. And it was just me trying to help one person. And as I began to engage with the account, this community grew. And I came to realize that other doctors were vulnerable. It wasn't just me, and that actually I had never been alone. So that is the power of vulnerability and the power of humanity. And that is why I suppose you have kindly asked me to come and sort of share my story. So if we kind of go back to the very beginning, I was a very sort of ambitious medical student, deeply passionate about medicine, but I had had mental illness as a child and as a teenager, and it was something that I sort of hid and carried in shame. I was somehow convinced that if the GMC found out that I'd been unwell, they would kind of have me struck off, as though I was kind of unsafe or unreliable just for merely having been mentally unwell as a child. And so that myth was never corrected. And so I kind of, like I said, carried it with this shame and secrecy. And not infrequently throughout my sort of medical school training and beyond, I was triggered by people around me, by colleagues who would refer to mental health patients as manipulative or psycho, mental, words that really were quite offensive. And I didn't really know what to do with those words other than sort of internalize them, come to believe them to be true about myself, I suppose. And so I did what I knew best, and that was just throw myself into medicine. And I loved it. I lived and I breathed medicine. The more I did, the more validated I became. I got my sense of worth from success, if you like, prizes and awards. And I know that's something that you spoke about in previous episodes, but it's something that I really identify with, this concept that as medicine, as you know, as doctors, we feel worthy because we achieve. And I really did fall into that trap. I think thereafter, I continued to be this high achieving trainee. I started pediatrics, I loved it. And then after the birth of my second daughter, I developed postnatal depression. And maternity leave was sort of spent on medication and in therapy. And then when it came to returning to work, I decided that I needed to disclose this. I'd been unwell. Although I was medically fit enough to work, I felt like I needed support. And so I reached out and I said, look, I've been unwell and I don't think that I should do my on call on my second day back at work. But unfortunately, a number of circumstances lined up and I was given the crash bleep for a tertiary children's hospital that I had never worked in before. And it broke me. And so I found a cupboard and I cried. And then I wiped my tears and I just got on with it, because as doctors, that's what we do. We just get on with it. And then I suppose things began to spiral from there. I became more and more anxious, more and more exhausted. I was falling asleep at traffic lights on the way to and from work. And yet every day I would try and turn up with a smile. The sort of empathy and compassion that I had had in abundance was turned into and replaced with this bitter resentment. I absolutely dreaded going to work. And I remember getting a call from my brilliant supervisor at the time. And he said, look, I need to talk to you. I really want to get you the help that you deserve. But in order to do that, I need to label you as a trainee in difficulty. And I was just completely silent. Because those three words suddenly defined me. Trainee in difficulty, this concept that my whole career, which up until then had been really successful, was suddenly defined by three words. But you know what? He was right. And I got the support that I needed. But by then it was too late. And I was already pretty sick. So people began talking about time off sick. And again, I just couldn't conceive of it. Like this massive black mark next to my name. Doctors don't get sick. Of course, I wouldn't take time off. I couldn't possibly take time off. And it was a few months later that my psychiatrist signed my sick note, and I sat in his office and I was sobbing my eyes out. I wasn't crying for myself. I was crying for the colleagues that I was burdening with all this extra work. And I was crying for my patients that I was letting down. But we don't learn to take care of ourselves or put ourselves first. We sort of sacrifice ourselves, drag ourselves into work regardless of how we feel. And that is the culture that we work in. And so that is what I had done. And 3 weeks off sick turned into 11 months off sick. And I got worse before I got better. A lot of medication and therapy. And I genuinely believed I would never possibly be a doctor again. But then with support from an amazing mentor and a supervisor who was brilliant at really trying to understand what I needed, I managed to return to medicine for a year as a pediatric registrar. And I proved to myself that I could be a doctor if I wanted to be. I just wasn't sure whether I did want to be.
Yeah, thank you for sharing all of that with us. And I think you made some really important points there. So a few things that sat with me were, first of all, thank you for speaking about postnatal depression, because I don't think we really speak about that often. And I think it's more common than we think it is.
Definitely.
So thank you for bringing that up. The fact that you had said, you know, on my second day back, I don't feel ready to do my own call. And then for various reasons, you then ended up having the tertiary crash bleep, which if you had some time off, regardless of having some time off and being unwell in that time off, coming back from time off, we shouldn't be putting people in those situations. And yet it happens so often because there are all these shortages and there's nobody else to carry it. And as you say, we don't kind of say, no, I'm not carrying it. We'll be like, oh, okay, fine. Then yes, I'm the doctor. I have to do it. But also what came through for me there was how important it is to get your supervisor who rang you and said, I want to make sure you get the right support. And then your supervisor and mentor, having that right support there is so, so helpful. And I guess the reason that I really wanted you to come on the podcast is for us to start thinking and speaking about doctors who might I don't really want to call it like a mental health condition, but I guess like a spectrum of things with mental health, and how all of us kind of do things to support them. And when you were speaking there, I think, you know, like when I was at medical school, I don't think we ever spoke about mental, and I was at medical school not that long ago. I don't think we really spoke about mental health of ourselves and our students and
colleagues. And as you say, we're in this environment where we don't get taught to look after ourselves. I think it's changing slightly now because we're realizing more and more that we're burning people out. And at least now on the GMC guidance, it does say that you have a duty to look after yourself as well. But I think a lot of us learned the hard way after burning out. I certainly learned that way, that actually I can't do anything without looking after myself first. So you've made so many important points there.
I think I see mental health in medicine as a bit of a spectrum. But for me, this isn't necessarily about mental illness. This is about everybody has mental health, and prevention is surely much better than waiting until people get sick. I have a lot of colleagues who have had signs of burnout. And, you know, where is the line between burnout and mental illness? Who knows? It becomes blurred at some point. But I think I am a very much a firm believer that what I went through shouldn't be what other people have to experience in order to get help. The help should be provided before then. When people are well, the systems should be changed so that none of this happens.
And also, it was really sad to hear that you had to be, you know, that somebody has to be labelled as a trainee in difficulty to get the support that they need. Because there's a lot of emotion that then happens with those labels, as you say, you know, we're all people who have been like really high achieving in school and then at medical school. Most of us really link our self-worth with our achievements. And then we get told something like that. It will have a huge effect. And I don't know if there was any kind of even like discussion about that and how you felt about it at the time. But I think these are all things that we all need to think about.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult because I've thought about this a lot since it happened. I mean, it was probably 5 years ago now, maybe a little bit longer. My supervisor knew the implications of the words and what the effects might be. I still carry a huge amount of shame, and I struggle to sort of shake off this feeling of failure as a result. But ultimately, that was the pathway at the time. I think things have changed a little bit in the last 5 years, and I think people are realizing that we can't just lump people into a box, because in that same box goes doctors who are perhaps struggling with their exams for whatever reason, people who are needing to take on caring responsibilities, IMGs who have just arrived in the country, people who are struggling with competency. By labeling everybody as a trainee or a doctor in difficulty, we fail to see the people as individuals. And ultimately, that is the crux of it. We, yes, need perhaps a label to identify that this person is in need of additional support, but why other them in the process? Essentially, I like to use now the sort of phrase, you know, this is a doctor who is navigating challenging circumstances, or something along those lines. It's not about me as a person. It is about the situation that I am living through and experiencing that is making it difficult for me.
Yeah, and saying doctor in distress kind of, it almost sort of puts a blame on the individual, whereas actually there's a whole system construct there that has led to the situation as well. You know, in what you were sharing with us, returning from being on maternity leave, really being quite unwell, and then being given a tertiary crash bleep, that's the system at fault there. So I'm always very particular about, we don't blame individuals, it's system issues, but then we can do things as individuals to make the system better. It would be great to hear a little bit more about what happened next with your story.
So back in 2019, I decided after a lot of reflection that I no longer felt able to be the doctor that I wanted to be. The system was too rigid. Training was too inflexible. I was sort of after a year of being very, very well supported, being a supernumerary training, coming off on calls, I was then being expected to rotate to a different hospital, start working nights in order to progress through my competencies. And I just wasn't in a position to be able to do that. And so I took matters into my own hands and I decided to leave. And so I hung up my stethoscope for good. I left a career that I had up until then absolutely loved. And that was and continues to be really difficult. But I threw myself straight into another career and I retrained as a primary teacher. And so that was incredibly eye-opening. I had always been told that I was a great teacher. And then I actually started teaching children and realized that, oh my goodness, I had no idea what I was doing at all. And then COVID happened. And so halfway through my training, my placement was suspended. And in this following September, I got my own class. So I was teaching 6 and 7 year olds. And it was the steepest learning curve that I have ever experienced. I spent quite a bit of those first few months feeling pretty overwhelmed. But being a primary teacher taught me to be a better pediatrician and a better doctor, undoubtedly. I began to see children way beyond the context of their medical illnesses, you know, create partnerships with families. And it's not something that I regret in any way, but I quite quickly began to miss medicine. And I think stepping away made me value what I had had in the first place. Perhaps what maybe burnout and mental illness had made me forget. And so I missed the unbelievable privilege that we have as doctors to be part of people's lives. I missed the teamwork, the complexity and intellectual challenge, the problem solving. I just missed being me because medicine was a massive part of my identity. And so in September 2022, I decided to return, or I should say start to return, because it has been quite a challenging journey. There is currently no national support for returning doctors. There is no scheme or funding. And I have relied on the kindness of individual doctors that I have encountered, some of whom have been incredibly kind and supportive. But once again, I find myself advocating, having to repeat my story constantly and battling to sort of find a place for myself in a system that is very rigid and not all that accommodating when it comes to people who can no longer fit the sort of training pathway.
And if we make the training pathway so that they don't fit people, it then kind of gives the message that, oh, well, unless you fit into this box, then you don't belong here. Whereas actually, that's not the case at all. It's we need to change this box so that everybody belongs in this space. And I just wonder whether you can share a few kind of ideas and reflections that you've had on how we can do that to make it more inclusive. I'm not at all expecting you to give us all the answers for this, but it'll be great to hear your kind of reflections on that.
I think for me, there's something about things that we can do at an individual level. And the biggest thing that I sort of speak about and advocate for is role modeling vulnerability and being brave enough to show our own frailties, if you like, our own vulnerability. It's not weakness, it's human. And if we have senior leaders within an organization, within a department who are able to talk about their emotions, discuss the tricky parts of their day or the way a clinical encounter has affected them emotionally, only then will other people within the department, particularly at a more junior level, feel able to share their own vulnerabilities. And that is how we create a movement where people feel able to speak out. So I'd say that is one of them. Secondly, having a space to do that. So having these, often people call them safe spaces, but an amazing friend and colleague called Dr. Anna Bavistock, who's a pediatric consultant in Somerset, she uses the word brave spaces. So this concept that I cannot tell you if the space is safe for you, I don't know whether it's safe or not, but I can create a brave space, a space where you feel able to come forward and share that vulnerability. And so lots of organizations are now sort of starting to use Schwartz rounds as a way of doing that. And I think people feel that these are very beneficial, a sort of place to reflect and share experiences. But more than just the physical space, it's about the culture and about feeling like you will not be judged or punished for sharing that story.
Yeah. And I think the things that you do share, I think they resonate with so many people because you are sharing your vulnerability and your humanness. And I think that's what it is that makes people, people really resonate regardless of what their own circumstances might be. I think we can all relate to that. And I think, as you say, it's such a, you know, it's a right, like we've got to go and do this and this needs to be done and that needs to be done. And you can end up getting to like the end of a shift and thinking, oh my goodness, I've had to deal with quite a few things that we just didn't stop to think about. And then we kind of just bottle up all of those emotions and carry on as if they don't affect us. And then they really, really do. Whereas actually having those spaces is so important. And I love that idea of calling it a brave space, because as you say, a lot of the time we do say like, oh, this is a safe space, but who's saying that it's safe? And just because it's safe for one person doesn't mean that it's safe for somebody else. You don't know who feels safe in that. So brave space, I will definitely be calling things a brave space rather than a safe space next time. So thank you.
I think there's also something about how we communicate our emotions within a department. And sometimes hierarchy is feared. So hierarchy is needed in leadership. Of course it is. But when we begin to break down that hierarchical structure, people feel able to speak more freely, to open up and challenge attitudes and behaviors. You know, Amy Edmondson, Tim Clark, there's lots of people who've done a huge amount of work on psychological safety and this concept that we can create an environment where it is safe to speak out and to challenge behaviors, to admit that we've made mistakes. And I think that a lot of this around mental health, mental illness, falls into that. We need to create an environment where it is okay to put your hand up and say, do you know what, I am not performing at my best, I need some help. And until we do that, until we have a culture that can encourage that, I think we can offer all kinds of resilience training and yoga sessions and mindfulness, but we're really not going to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think patients as well value that when we share our humanness. So I'm on neonates at the moment, and I think it was, I can't remember if it was a night, I'm post nights at the moment, my brain is all just like blurring together, but it was a shift where like it was really busy, I hadn't eaten, and I think some parents had asked for an update, and I said, are you going to be around for a little while, is it okay if I very quickly go and eat something and then I can come and I can speak to you properly, because I'll be much better if I've eaten something rather than sitting there trying to talk to you whilst thinking I'm feeling very hypoglycemic and I need to go and eat something. And they were like, oh yeah, of course, that's fine. And then they actually really appreciated that, you know, rather than me plowing through being like, oh yes, yeah, fine, let me speak to them. And me kind of saying to them, actually, if I go and eat something, I will come back as a better version of me to then be able to sit and go through everything with you in a better way. And they really value that rather than us kind of carrying on pretending that we're machines.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's really important. And, you know, patients do want humanity in healthcare. You know, that's a sort of a given. I think, you know, I don't know if you've heard of Professor Michael West. He's done a huge amount of work in the sort of field of compassionate leadership. And he comes up and describes three core needs that we have as health professionals. One of them is autonomy. So autonomy being this idea that we need to feel empowered, that our voice needs to be heard, that we have a say in the clinical care that we deliver or the organizational systems that we work within. B is belonging. So belonging, this concept of being part of a team, feeling valued and having a place within that team. And thirdly, contribution. So contribution is that concept that what we are doing needs to matter or needs to feel like it matters, like we are making a difference. And I think when we think about those core needs, we need to sort of keep those in mind when it comes to designing systems and support that we're going to put in place. Because fundamentally, if people feel like their voice is being heard, if they feel like they belong, and if they feel like they are contributing and have purpose and meaning, they are much more likely to thrive at work.
I hadn't come across Michael West, so thank you for telling me about him and his work. That, yeah, I think that sounds like, as you say, like the really important things that we do need to thrive at work. And I think we do need to think about helping people thrive rather than at the moment it's all just, I mean, even not just at the moment, I think it's always just been about survival rather than actually how do we help people to thrive. Thank you so much for everything that you've shared with us. I'd like to ask you some quick fire questions now, if that's okay. So and you will know all these because you listen to the podcast. I get lovely messages from you about the podcast. So thank you. So the first question is there a book or several books that you'd recommend for our listeners to read?
So I think a book that was sort of suggested to me by one of my Twitter followers was Listen by Catherine Mannix. I don't know if you've read it yourself, but it is an incredible book. Catherine Mannix is a palliative care consultant, and she shares her wisdom about communication and importantly the words that we say, but probably more importantly the words that we don't say, and how simply listening can add so much to a conversation and can really sort of bring out those special moments. It's definitely one to add to your reading list, which I know is already quite long.
Yep, but I will definitely add that one as well. Is there anything that you know now that you wish you had known earlier on in your career?
I think I wish while I had been unwell that I could have seen where I am now, that I could have realized that it was all going to be okay and that things don't always go how you had planned them to, but that's okay. Ride the waves and you'll come out the other side. And also that not every career path is linear.
Yeah, I think those are really important lessons. And my last question, which you will know, is from the RCPCH and Us group. And the question is, if you were a type of biscuit, what type of biscuit would you be and why?
So I love this question because clearly children love asking it. When I was interviewed to be a primary teacher, I was asked this question by the children as well. So.
Oh, amazing.
My answer has actually changed. I would be a homemade biscuit. A homemade biscuit that is decorated by my children with loads of brightly coloured sprinkles and icing that probably has all sorts of extra bits in it that may or may not be delicious to eat. But essentially, I am a perfectly imperfect homemade biscuit.
That's such a beautiful answer. And I've not had any homemade biscuits yet on the podcast, so I'm really glad that we've got a homemade biscuit.
There you go. I think that's my point, is that I don't fit the standard box anymore. That's okay, though. I'm coming to realise that that's okay.
And why can't we all be homemade biscuits and be different? And yeah, I don't think I've even thought, like, I've never even thought to say that as an answer. And neither has anybody else, because everyone automatically finds a biscuit that they can buy in a shop. So yeah, how fascinating. I love this question.
Yeah, I think it is because we are primed to fit and conform, and actually being unique and different is sometimes difficult. But I am, like I say, coming to realize that it's all right to be a little bit different.
Well, I would love to have a homemade biscuit decorated by your children, because it sounds great. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and also for all the support that you show the podcast as well, because you do share it out and share things about episodes. So thank you for that as well.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a real honour. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for listening to the Medical Women podcast. Make sure to subscribe for free on whichever podcast platform you listen on, so that you automatically get our episodes. The aim of this podcast is to support and empower as many medical women in their careers as we possibly can. So please share this episode with at least one other medical woman. If you're interested in joining the Medical Women's Federation, we would love to have you. And all links to our website and social media are in the show notes. This podcast has been produced on behalf of the Medical Women's Federation by Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram and Miss Jenna McKenzie. Our music was composed and played by Dr. Kethaki Bayankaram. Thank you so much for listening.